This New York Times podcast is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features turn-by-turn directions. Sync locates your destination in seconds and then audibly guides you through all your turns without additional hardware to purchase. Sync is a system that's subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with memoirist Darren Strauss about the accident that changed his life.
When I got married, when my wife told me she was pregnant, I thought about Celine because I was living the life that she didn't get to live.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Jennifer Egan discusses her review of a brilliant new novel.
I would urge the reader to read it, to feel the kind of convergence of all of these different ideas. He makes them all feel like they are about one thing, one deep primordial will to express that it comes from something much deeper than human beings.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. In his harrowing new memoir, Half a Life, novelist Darren Strauss describes an accident that changed his world forever. Darren Strauss recently visited the Times to talk about his new memoir and the events it describes that haunt him to this day.
This is a one-of-a-kind story. Tell us about it.
I was in a car accident in high school. I was in the far left lane of a sort of mini highway, and far ahead on the right shoulder was a bicyclist, a young girl, and as I approached, she cut across two lanes and into my car and died. And even though we were a few towns over from where I lived, it turned out she had gone to my high school. And I was a senior and she was a junior, and she died, and it was just an awful thing, obviously. Her parents were very nice in the beginning. The police, I should say this, of course, early on, the police and five cars of eyewitnesses testify that it wasn't my fault.
She'd actually swerved for an unaccountable reason. She was with a group of bike riders.
She was with one other bicyclist. She was, again, on the shoulder and swerved not only across one lane but across two lanes. And so it was very unexpected, and I did my best and tried to...
And you were sober.
And I was sober. I was... Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah, I was 18. It was 11 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday or Saturday. So all these eyewitnesses said it hadn't been my fault, and her parents at the funeral, which I attended, said they knew it wasn't my fault, and whatever I did in my life, I had to do it twice as well now because I was doing it for two people, which was a heavy burden, but I accepted it. And then a few months later, they sued me for millions of dollars. And so the book is not really about the lawsuit so much as just coming to terms with guilt and grief and feeling guilty over something you might not necessarily be culpable for, but do feel guilt about.
Well, and you were a kid, right? You're 18 years old. You're getting ready to go to Tufts. Your life is about to begin. And in some way, it ends. Another life ends and becomes entangled with yours. So how do you proceed? How do you go forward?
Well, it's interesting hearing you even say that, because this was a big secret for me. This is something I didn't tell anybody. And then so to hear you say the details of my life about this is very strange, because I treated Tufts. I went to school a few months later. It happened in late May of 88, and in September I was in school. So I treated college like a witness protection program. I went there, sort of changed all my identity except for my name. I didn't tell anyone. And spent my 20s and early 30s sort of having this secret that I kept from the world, and became a fiction writer, and so wrote these books.
That in some way drew on this.
Yeah.
But in very imaginative and oblique ways.
Oblique even to me. That was the strange thing. I mean, there's a quote I love from Saul Bellow where he said, and I'm probably going to butcher it, but he didn't want to go to therapy because he didn't want to know why he was writing what he was writing about. I think that was true with me until this book. I wrote three novels before this. And I didn't know until I wrote this book that they were all about this thing. I mean, my first book was called Chang and Ang. It was about conjoined twins. So it was about two people who were attached and in the most profound way, and who were living with this relationship that was inextricably bound up together. And that's sort of how I was with the girl who died. And my second book was called The Real McCoy, and it was about a guy with a secret in his life. He lived a false identity, And my third novel is called More Than Hurts You, and that's about a family that lives with a great secret and a lawsuit, an unfair lawsuit brought against somebody. So it's obvious in retrospect, but, you know, when you're in the middle of an imaginative project, you don't, at least I didn't stop and say, oh, yeah, this is why I'm writing about that. And it'll be interesting for me now to go back to fiction, because now that I know why I'm writing about these things, maybe it'll be harder to draw on that material.
Which raises the question why you decided to write Half a Life.
It's funny, because I thought I would never write about it. You know, I as I said, I wrote three books before this, and just assumed it would be something I kept to myself. But when my wife was pregnant with our now almost three-year-old boys, I was 36, and so the accident had happened half my life ago, and that's sort of why I call it Half a Life, although there are other metaphorical reasons. And I was about to become a parent, and so I started thinking about the accident in more profound ways, and I thought I should deal with this thing that I'd sort of put aside, or thought I'd put aside, but must have been central to who I was in ways that I hadn't dealt with yet. And so I just decided to write about it, because as a writer, that's how I sort of figure out what I think about things. And I actually wrote in a sort of aborted early version of this that wasn't any good, that I worked with someone at The New Yorker on and then decided to scrap. And then, again, just kept writing about it. And I thought I would do it for myself. And then a friend who does some things for This American Life said, you should show it to them. And I did, and they liked it. And so I did a This American Life piece on it, and I thought that would be the end of it. But I got literally hundreds of emails from people, different in kind from the emails I usually get. You know, if you write a fictional work, it's usually someone saying, I didn't like the book, or I liked the book, and that's it. These were people saying, this was really profoundly helpful for me, which sounds really sanctimonious and self-serving, or at least to me it does. So I'm sort of anxious about even saying it. But that really was one of the reasons I did it, because there hadn't been a story, as far as I knew, about this kind of accident, which the police call dart outs, and which insurance companies call no-fault deaths. And there are 2,000 of them a year. And in doing research, I found out that people who are in this kind of accident are much more likely to suffer from post-traumatic stress than are people who are at fault. And I think it's because the brain can't, or has trouble dealing with a random event. You know, if you were a drunk driver, you could look back and say, if I only hadn't been drunk. But when you look back and you can't figure out how it would change anything, or what you could do would change anything, that's very hard to deal with, and so the brain, I think, kind of shuts down. So I realized, had there been a book about this when I was 18, it would have been very helpful. So I thought I would give it a shot, and it was very cathartic.
Now, what about the girl, Celine's family? Well, do they know you've written this book? Did you speak with them?
I changed her name for the book. It's not her real name, but I hadn't been in touch with them at all since they sued me. People I was close to were very angry that they sued me, because they had promised me that they wouldn't. But, you know, I was in no position to judge, obviously. I mean, burying a child must be the hardest thing. So I obviously bore them no ill will, but I just thought they didn't want me in their life. I didn't really want to be in their life. So I hadn't talked to them in 20 years. But I thought I owed it to them to let them know the book was coming out, especially when I started getting press for it. So I searched for them, and it was very hard. They moved, and I had to call a bunch of teachers I went to school with, and finally found their address a few weeks ago and wrote them a letter saying, you know, the book is coming out. I just wanted to warn you, so I don't want you to run into it at a bookstore. And of course, I've been thinking about you all these years, and I hope you're well. But that's pretty much been the extent of it. And they haven't responded, so I don't know. But I did dedicate the book to them, and I think the only way I can justify doing it is if it's respectful to their daughter's memory and is as hard on myself as possible. And so hopefully I did that.
Her memory is something you carry with you. She's present still in your consciousness really every day.
Sure. I mean, it's been 20 years, so I don't know every day, to be frank, but at all my big moments, you know, I mentioned in the book when I got married, when my wife told me she was pregnant, I thought about Celine, because I was living the life that she didn't get to live. And so I guess that I did carry, I did carry her mother's injunction with me. I was sort of living my life for two people in a way, because I'm very cognizant all the time that I'm able to live and do these things that she's not able to do. And again, I don't think it, I mean, I'm sure it wasn't my fault. That's something that I came to terms with in writing the book. and that it wasn't really my story. It's a story about a girl who made a mistake. And I tried my best. And as I say in the book, you know, you can try your human best at the toughest moments, and sometimes you come up short, and that's all you can do. I mean, she swerved. I did my best not to hit her, and she died. You know, who's to say if I had had better reflexes, I wouldn't have been able to miss her. I don't think so, but you know, you'll never know. And that doubt is where the doubt lived, and the guilt lived. So yeah, it's very tough to live with that kind of thing, and I think that a lot of people have that kind of grief or guilt about certain things that might not be their fault. I'm very wary of self-help books and memoirs in general, to be frank, but I hope if I did my job that it's a self-helpful book, if not a self-help book.
Thanks a lot, Darren.
Thank you for having me.
This New York Times podcast is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features turn-by-turn directions. Sync locates your destination in seconds and then audibly guides you through all your turns over your car or SUV's audio speaker system without additional hardware to purchase. You can also save several destinations you may use frequently, such as home, and Sync will guide you there. Sync is a system that's subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
Fall books. Let's talk about someone other than Jonathan Franzen. What other novels or nonfiction books should we know about?
Well, summer is over, of course, and now it's time for everyone to come back from the Hamptons and start working on Friday afternoons again. And this is the time of year when there are a ton of books coming out in the fall. A few books coming out, there are novels coming out by Ken Follett. We have Nicole Krauss has a new book. Tom Clancy has his first book in about 8 years, returning Jack Ryan. Michael Cunningham, the author of The Hours, has a new book, which a couple of booksellers I talked to have said is brilliant. And then we have a new Bob Woodward book on the nonfiction side coming out in a few weeks. And that book's title is Obama's Wars, and it's about Iraq and Afghanistan.
Julie, do we have a sense that this may be a successful, even profitable autumn for book publishers?
There's certainly a lot of people who are very optimistic that that's going to be the case. Tony Blair's memoir of his years as prime minister just came out, and it debuted at number 3 on the bestseller list for September 19th. There are quite a few political memoirs, quite a few political books, books about the Tea Party. Condoleezza Rice has a memoir about her childhood in Alabama. Bill O'Reilly has a new book. Glenn Beck has a new book. Dana Milbank, the reporter for the Washington Post, has a biography of Glenn Beck, which could be interesting.
Julie, do we have a sense with some of these big new books, including a novel like Freedom by Jonathan Franzen, that some of the early sales are actually ebook sales? Do we have any figures or any sense of how they're doing in that form?
Amazon is very resistant to releasing ebook sales in terms of figures, but certainly we saw with the Stieg Larsson book that continues to sell very, very well in ebook format. At least 1 million copies of the book in digital form have been sold. And the Franzen book, when you look at the Kindle bestseller list on Amazon, the Franzen book is doing very, very well. There is kind of a close parallel to the books that are doing well in hardcover, but certainly for the Franzen book, the ebook sales don't seem to be cannibalizing the print sales, because that also debuted as number 1 on the New York Times bestseller list.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Tom McCarthy is one of the most ambitious young novelists. His second book is out. It's called Sea. It's reviewed by another ambitious novelist, Jennifer Egan, and she's here to talk about it. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you.
You say in your quite exquisite review that there's a lot McCarthy doesn't tell us about in the story he may not be telling us. What does he do? What kind of writer is he? And what's he doing in this novel?
You know, it's interesting because I think in serious, ambitious fiction, you often have two levels of things going on. There's the surface level of people doing things and human dramas and wondering what's going to happen to people. And then ideally, under that and sort of percolating up through it are all kinds of ideas and questions and philosophical issues and often a kind of language structure that reflects all that with metaphor and even things that the reader's not so much aware of. And what's so interesting about this book is that I think Tom McCarthy has essentially reversed those two layers so that what he foregrounds is all of that intellectual girding, all of the ideas and the language structures and patterns. And what ends up getting recessed are the human dramas that we normally are reading for. So it's a fascinating switch, very risky. But the reason he pulls it off, I think, is that the ideas are so fascinating and his way of exploring them is so bold and the language is so powerful and flexible and innovative that he actually manages to make all of that tremendously compelling, so that we're reading as much as anything else to know how on earth he's going to, what he'll do next, and how he'll pull it off. It's a real high wire act.
Now, he has, I believe, pretty serious background as a philosopher, at least student of philosophy. What are some of the ideas that he's exploring in C?
Well, I think he's pretty interested in semiotics and coding and language and how codes work through us. You know, the idea that, and I was a bit steeped in this myself in college, you know, that to understand something is in a sense to stand under it, that language works through us and makes us who we are. We think we are using it to express ideas, but in fact, it is expressing ideas through us that have to do with the culture or the milieu that we're part of and even who we are individually, but less that than these larger patterns and forces that are working us through us in the code of language. I felt a lot of that going on in this book.
And what kinds of forces can you give us an example of?
Well, I mean, the book is incredibly eclectic. I mean, it runs the gamut from, you know, it's especially interested in the moment when wireless technology was really exploding. And he does a great job of suggesting all kinds of, in a way, very obvious parallels between that moment and this one. But he ends up, and he concludes his book in ancient Egyptian settings where we are hearing a lot about hieroglyphics, all kinds of Egyptian mythology, funerary rites, and all of that. There is a strong sense that I wouldn't try to capture myself, but I would urge the reader to read it to feel the kind of convergence of all of these different ideas. He makes them all feel like they are about one thing, one deep primordial will to express that it comes from something much deeper than human beings. I guess that's really the philosophical leap that he makes or that he tries to explore, the idea that ideas and language are working through humans coming from some much, much deeper place that no one can ultimately identify, but that expresses itself in all kinds of different iterations, many, many of which he explores in the book.
Are there characters?
I know, I can imagine people going, there absolutely are characters. And the central character is a guy named Serge, and his name is, of course, a pun. It's spelled S-E-R-G-E, but there's you know, the sense of an electrical current is one of the many metaphors that McCarthy explores through the book. And so, of course, the idea of a guy named Serge is very suggestive. He is a kind of fascinating guy. He has many different moments in his life. He begins his life on a silk-producing estate in England. His mother is French. She's clearly a drug addict. But these are the kinds of stories that are somewhat recessed. We know that she's a drug addict, and we know that he almost dies because while stoned on opium, we think, she neglects her two-year-old son, Serge, who falls into a creek and almost drowns. So there are dramatic events right from the beginning. His sister, with whom he's extremely extremely close, and that's probably the strongest emotional aspect of the book, his deep, deep love for her and his longing for her, which are never explored directly, nevertheless come through very strongly. She commits suicide, although her family somehow convinces themselves that it's an accident, at age 17, having gotten involved with a family friend. But again, you could almost miss some of this if you're not reading really carefully. Serge heads out. He fights in World War I. He becomes a drug addict, and he ultimately goes to work in communications in Egypt, in present-day, newly independent Egypt. He has all kinds of adventures along the way, but what really motivates him is his own fascination with meaning, with the question of what is underneath everything else, what he can read behind the patterns around him. When he's on heroin, those patterns have a kind of druggy William Burroughs quality. When he's working as a fighter pilot or as a bomber, the second guy in the plane, he sees things more through that lens. But whatever it is, he's looking for patterns and trying to read them, if you will.
Jenny, when you read a novel like this for review, do you read it the way any engaged, interested reader would do, or as a sometimes experimental novelist yourself, do you say, okay, he's pushing this button here, he's manipulating that wire over there, oh, I know what he's up to with this one. Do you know what I mean? Is it almost like the way like a film director might look at someone else's work and see beyond the image on the screen to the mechanics behind it? Or are you able to set that aside?
Well, I think this book absolutely, delightedly invites the reader to read it in that way. If you're not interested in the mechanics behind it, if you just want to read a book about people, a moving story about people going through emotional things, this is not the book for you. I don't think I'm betraying Tom McCarthy at all by saying that. I think he would say the same thing. This is really a book that is explicitly about the will to probe deeper than that. So what I try to do as a reviewer is read the book in the terms it was meant to be read. There is no point in sitting down and saying, well, gee, I really feel like this kind of a book. Let's see what so-and-so did. That's not being a good reviewer. So I try to figure out quickly, and you know, one usually can, what is being attempted and read it in that spirit. My personal proclivities definitely veer toward the sort of strenuously intellectual stuff. So it's exciting to encounter a book that really demands to be read in that way, because that I love that.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
My pleasure.
That's Jennifer Egan, who reviews Tom McCarthy's novel Sea on the cover of this week's book review. Jennifer Schussler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
There's got to be something new on the list this week.
Well, there are some things that are new on the list, but first of all, inevitably, we have to talk about what's old. Stieg Larsson, I'm getting so sick of saying those two words, is back on top of the fiction list with A Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. James Patterson, our American hero, tried to do something about this. He was on top last week with his novel, The Postcard Killers. He even got a Swedish co-author, Liza Marklund. They had their week at number one. Now Larsson has bumped him down to number two, if not yet bumped him off. But we'll see what happens. A couple new fiction titles. Anne Fortier enters at number 14 with a novel called Juliet. It's about a woman who digs into her Italian ancestry and discovers that she is a descendant of Shakespeare's doomed romantic heroine. And if that's not escapist enough for you, Terry Brooks, the fantasy author, is at number five, with Bearers of the Black Staff, the latest of his swashbuckling adventures in the mythic Four Lands.
What about nonfiction?
There's a new guy on top. David Limbaugh is up there with Crimes of Liberty, a political indictment of the Obama presidency. Yes, he is the younger brother of Rush, and yes, they pretty much think alike. Rush has really been pumping his brother's book on his radio show, and here he is at number one. A couple of other new titles, both of which our readers may have heard about in our pages recently. Eliza Griswold, who was on the podcast a couple weeks ago, enters at number 14 with her book, The Tenth Parallel. You'll remember it's sort of a geopolitical travelogue across that latitude, looking at clashes between Christians and Muslims. Totally different flavor. Gail Caldwell enters at number 7 with Let's Take the Long Way Home, her memoir of her friend Caroline Knapp, the writer who died of lung cancer at age 42.
Well, we can all kind of here, at least, feel pretty good about Gail Caldwell because she was a book critic at one time.
She was. She was the chief critic for the Boston Globe for many years, winner of a Pulitzer Prize, and she spent a lot of years dishing it out, and now that she's a writer, she's got to take it. And I emailed her to ask her what that was like, and she said, this is what she said to me. "I'm amazed by the fortitude of writers who don't read reviews of their work. They're either Vikings or embellishers. I learn a lot from reviews, however gratifying or excruciating. I have to say, almost none of the reviews of this book, or maybe none of the ones I've seen, have been at all excruciating. It's gotten great reviews."
That's why she can afford to say it. Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.